Greetings, everyone. I'm Lieutenant Commander Mark, 1/4 of the Trek Soup crew. The crew and I would like to thank everyone who has watched our premiere episode discussion on the classic Star Trek original series episode, Balance of Terror. Our next live episode will be Monday, September 20th at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time via our Facebook page, www.facebook.com/TrekSoup, and then available for audio the next day. For those of you that would like to follow along and perhaps partake in the live discussion, we will be going over the Season 3, Episode 4, The Enterprise Incident. Now here on Trek Soup, I'm the Chief of Operations, but not only do I manage our feeds, I also provide behind-the-scenes facts from episodes that we go over. Here's a sneak peek fact for the Enterprise Incident. Did you know photographic effects using special mats were produced of the D7 class studio model? That's the D7 Cruiser or the D7 Battlecruiser, a 23rd century warship originally designed and used by the Klingon Imperial Fleet before being used by the Romulan military during the late 2260s. That, when combined, gave the appearance that three warships had surrounded the Enterprise during that episode. Now, more fun behind-the-scenes facts, and for more facts on the Enterprise incident, be sure to tune in Monday, September 20th at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time via our Facebook page, www.facebook.com/TrekSoup. And be sure to follow us on Instagram at TrekSoup. Now on to the premiere audio episode here on Anchor. So buckle up, disengage the external inertial dampener, and punch it to max warp with us, the crew of TrekSoup.
Hey, Trek fans. Vice Admiral Jim here. Welcome to the very first episode of Trek Soup. We're going to be talking all things Trek, and we're specifically going to do episode reviews, and we got a great one here for you tonight. But first, happy Labor Day. I hope you had a good weekend and a good day. We're going to talk about the episode Balance of Terror, Season 1, Episode 14. A lot of good things are going on. One of my very favorite episodes, you're going to hear me say that a lot because I really love the original series, and a lot of these things are going to, you know, are going to make me say that. It's just going to come out of me. But anyway, who knew that Lieutenant Uhura was so proficient at ballet? Who knew Yeoman Rand was going to take any opportunity to get up close to Captain Kirk? And bigotry rears its evil and scary head for the first time ever in Starfleet. Okay, we're going to break it all down to you. But first, guys, I want to beam in the crew here. We have Admiral Joe. Admiral, how you doing, sir?
Good. And you?
Doing very well. Thank you so much. I'm glad to be doing this with you guys. These are the best people that I could have chosen, although we could chosen for crewmates here. And we are, of course, all a part of Admiral Joe's crew. Admiral, tell me, what is your first experience with Star Trek? How old were you? Who introduced you to Star Trek, all that stuff. Tell us about that.
I was around 8 years old. I started off with Next Generation, watching Encounter at Farpoint. And I was just fascinated with all the technology, seeing the Enterprise and Picard walking on the bridge. And from there, the rest is history.
Literally.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Very good. So tell us. So, by the way, Admiral Joe is going to be our expert with canon, with ships, with all of that kind of cool Starfleet stuff as we go along here on Trek Soup. So one question for you, Admiral, what is your favorite ship class and why?
The Excelsior class. I always love the Excelsior. I call it the old queens of the fleet, and the Admiral's chariot, because every Admiral in Starfleet has used it as its their personal flagship. And it's lasted well into the 24th century. It's outlasted every other starship.
It certainly has. In fact, Excelsior was still being used in the Dominion War, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's definitely got that durability. Okay, Folks, moving down the list, we have Lieutenant Commander Mark. Mark, how are you, sir?
I'm doing well, Jim. Thank you.
Very good, very good. So, guys, Mark is going to be he's our Chief of Ops. So he actually set this whole thing up, and he's working behind the scenes to keep it running as smoothly as possible, together with Ali as well. So, Mark, let's see. Tell me, what's your favorite Star Trek series?
Oh, my favorite Star Trek series, to begin with, I would say would be Star Trek The Next Generation.
Aha.
Now, although I did start with reruns of the original series on Channel 11, PIX 11.
Yep, me too.
And I grew fondly attached to Spock because of his ears. And as a child, I had big ears, more specifically, more big earlobes. So I was like, hey, there's a guy with big ears and he's in charge. So I was like, I like him. Then, of course, I also like Scotty just for his, you know, he'll never give up. He'll does whatever he can to make the ship run. Next Generation, though, is near and dear to my heart. It's very fantastic episodes. Once I started watching it, I couldn't stop.
Excellent. I share a lot of those sentiments. But original series was my thing growing up. But anyway, enough about me. Let's go to Ali. Ali is, of course, our chief engineer. How you doing, Lieutenant Ali?
I'm doing awesome. Thanks for having me, guys.
Yeah, sure. Very, very good. So Ali, Ali's going to handle our social commentary, okay? And she's going to talk about parallels between real life and Star Trek, things like that. That's going to be her sphere of influence right there. Ali, let's see. Your favorite Star Trek series and why?
My favorite series, I think, has to be Deep Space Nine. Next Generation was my first foray into Star Trek, and I love that. Like Mark, it's very dear to my heart. But there was something about Deep Space Nine that it all kind of took place on one central location, and all of the, rather than going out to a planet, the planets came to the starbase, and I thought that was kind of cool. And I very, very much loved the dynamic between Odo and Quark. I thought they were just so, so funny watching it. There's just something special about it. I don't know. I couldn't tell you specifically why. It's my favorite.
Yeah. Well, you're certainly not alone at all. If you'd have put, go ahead, Admiral.
No, I just wanted to throw in, although I started out with Next Generation, like Ali, my favorite series has always been DS9, because it takes on a different look. It doesn't start off with the 5-year mission on a starship. It starts off on a starbase, and it also puts an African American in command of a starbase as well as a starship eventually.
Yep. Very important. Very, very important. Ali, if you were to pick one single character out of all the Star Trek series, all the Star Trek shows, who would it be and why? You knew you were going to get this.
I knew it. My absolute favorite is Data. His story, I've always been interested in science fiction, particularly like AI robots. Like, I loved Isaac Asimov, all that stuff. And like watching his journey from, you know, wanting to be, it's like the Pinocchio story, like wanting to be a real boy. He wants to be human. Watching him learn how humans work, it shows how we all are human through the eyes of something that's not human at all. And if anybody has seen, I won't spoil it, but if anybody has seen the new Picard series, I think Data's story is like truly beautifully tied up in a perfect bow. It's just, he's just so good. I love everything about Data and what he represents.
I 100% agree about how it was tied up very nicely, and it was tugging on our Star Trek fan heartstrings a little bit. But that's for another whole episode of Trek Soup. If you're wondering about me, I've already said, the original series, you know, it was my first introduction to Star Trek. I have my father to thank for that. My father was always a big, big sci-fi fan. And so, of course, he got me into it as well. I also have him to thank for my love of space and astronomy, which is part of the job I actually do in real life. But anyway, I can remember, I'm going to age myself a little bit here, but I can remember one Christmas morning, my parents got me a cassette recorder. Yes.
Oh my God.
Okay. A cassette recorder. I thought this was just the greatest thing ever. And I'm recording everybody. I'm recording my sisters. I'm recording my parents. I must have been a pain in their ass. And of course, one of the very first things I tried to tape was each and every single episode of Star Trek, of course, in reruns, like you, Mark, I think you said, on Channel 11, right? I wanted to do each and every one. And so here I was with the recorder right by the TV, watching it with my parents. But I also have a parallel to kind of you, Joe. My second favorite series would be Voyager. And it's a lot of parallels there. You know, you had Deep Space Nine has the first African-American commander or captain, the first woman captain, of course, in Voyager. Something was really appealing to me about a Federation starship out in the middle of nowhere in the Delta Quadrant where they had no help from Starfleet. They had to rely only on themselves and any allies they could find. Anyway, that's my whole story there. All right, so let's get into this episode a little bit, Balance of Terror, folks. But before we get into the real details and the nitty-gritty, Mark, can what can you tell us about some background info about this episode, some basic stuff?
Yeah, so hey guys, Mark here again. Before we get into the nitty-gritty, the background episode information first aired December 15th, 1966. It is written by Paul Schneider. He's an American screenwriter who wrote not only Balance of Terror for TOS, but also The Squire of Gathos. And he also wrote a Star Trek The Animated Series episode, The Tyrant Incident. He and his wife, Margaret, also wrote an episode for Gene Roddenberry's The Lieutenant, and they also wrote a show for Buck Rogers in the 25th Century. The episode that we're about to discuss saw the introduction of the Romulan Star Empire in Star Trek. Now, Paul Schneider, the writer, is accredited with creating the Romulans. Schneider remarked, "It was only a matter of developing a good Romanesque set of admirable antagonists that were worthy of Kirk. I came up with the concept of the Romulans, which was an extension of Roman civilization to the point of space travel, and it turned out quite well." That's according to the Captain's Log, the Unauthorized Complete Star Trek Voyages, page 34.
I always thought it was, you know, strange. Here's this completely alien race, but they're, you know, following Earth Roman history. What's up with that? As cool as I thought it was, and, you know, full disclosure, I still think it is, but I think probably not something that when we finally venture out to distant parts of the galaxy or to the quadrant, to put it in Star Trek terms, probably not going to find, you know, Romulans that are following the origin of Rome and things like that. But anyway, we'll get more into Romulans as we go along here with the episode, guys. But I want to, so the episode starts out very, very interesting. The wedding scene. Okay, I'm going to go to Allie first. Now, let's get rid of that. So Ensign Angela Martine, we're introduced to her. Okay, now she's obviously religious. This is one of the few times we see religion in Star Trek, especially human religion, in the chapel scene. And yes, Enterprise has a chapel. This is, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, the only time we see the chapel in the Enterprise. Of course, we have other series that introduce places of worship. There are no recognizable religious symbols, however, in this chapel. But there are some symbols anyway, and the episode makes a point of showing Angela kneeling at the altar, okay, doing a silent prayer. This is a common practice, of course, for many Christian religions. Allie, just your thoughts on that whole scene there.
We had discussed the cage about, there's a line where the Tolosians say hell is, it's implied that it's hell, like a fable, like a tall tale, a story, like it's not actually real, but it's something that you've sort of been told as a child, and that's some kind of
right, the scene,
false narrative.
The scene where we see Pike burning in hell. Like, mm-hmm. yeah, okay.
Yeah, and I think there's still a lot of that in this scene, in a way. I did kind of feel like the kneeling, it's a very common wedding thing to have, especially if you're having a wedding at a church, which was relatively commonplace in 1966. It's something that you probably would have done yourself. You would have had your wedding at a church. You probably would have kneeled. And I think that having that in just the chapel having no religious iconography, not just of human religions, but any religions, there's no references to really anything that specifically Catholic practices would not really that they would have died out, but they would have kind of been sort of mashed together right. by the time we're traveling into space, that really it would be just Earth. This is Earth's religion. But there would still be little holdout bits of, here's a little bit of Catholicism, here's a little bit of Shinto, here's a little bit of Islam, here's, you know, everything is kind of smattered together at that point.
Makes sense.
That it was relatively very forward-thinking at the time, thinking ahead to, oh, you know, Christianity is not going to be the dominant religion. It's going to be all religions competing equally as a whole, basically, or even the lack of religion, as you know, you can see there's nothing in the chapel. So even the lack of religion is just as perfectly accepted as having religion, which I think was, like I said, pretty big for the 60s.
Agreed. Yeah. And of course we do get other glimpses of religion in places specifically like Deep Space Nine, right? So mm-hmm. in Deep Space Nine, we really get into the Bajoran religion very heavily, and all kinds of things like that. But Joe, going back to this wedding scene, now it in watching this scene, it really got to me how, okay, they're all in the chapel. It is the wedding ceremony. It's they're tying the knot. This is it, right? It's not the rehearsal. But this is not a wedding dress, and I know you're in space, you're serving on a Starfleet vessel. You probably can't get your hands on a wedding on a Vera Wang, you know. It'd probably be a little rough to do, although you probably could replicate one. But anyway, but what about dress uniforms? I mean, these two guys, Martine and Tomlinson, they're both officers, so they do have dress uniforms. Mm-hmm. Why aren't they wearing those, do you think? And especially Kirk is up there he's officiating. Why isn't he in his dress uniform, which we've seen particularly him in his dress uniform in a few episodes throughout the original series? Any comments on that?
The only speculation I have with that is it might've been a budgetary thing where they just didn't have enough money to make the dress uniform for everybody. Only like the main characters, Spock, McCoy, Scotty and Kirk. And I also think it could have been they were in the middle of a mission, so they, you know, it was kind of like a rush thing, like, okay, we got to do this, but we still got to stick to the mission.
Yeah, true. Unfortunately, your first answer there with budget, this is something that's going to rear its ugly head throughout all three mm-hmm. seasons of the original series. And guys, long term, if you guys are out there watching, long term problem with the original series is their budget. They were just handicapped the whole time throughout all three seasons, especially season one. Season two, I think they got a little bit more, but season three, they got even lower than season one. So budget was the problem. And yeah, I mentioned it a little bit in the beginning. Joe, I know you and I have spoken about this offline. Mm-hmm. Why is Yeoman Rand up there on the dais with Kirk? You know, every opportunity to get close to this captain, yeah. You know.
I think that could have been her own little, like, maybe she could have asked, like, the director, hey, can I just stand by Kirk and, yeah, the scene or something like, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we know, maybe she's eye candy in the series. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, but I'm thinking, is she lighting candles? I mean, what is she doing back there? I'm not sure what her role is in the entire episode anyway. But anyway, so we're going to get back to the Romulans here. One of the main topics of the episode. So, Allie, this is our first look at these Romulans, like Mark has already spoken about, who would, of course, become a longtime Federation enemy, right? They almost go out of their way in this episode to establish that the Earth-Romulan War, and by the way, we're still in the original, in the first season of the original series, where they're not using the word Federation or Starfleet, they're using Earth. It's very Earth-centric, but anyway. The Earth-Romulan War, they go out of their way to say that it was primitive and that they don't know what the other look like. Of course, Spock comments that, of course, humans think that Romulans to be cruel and warlike. But later, the Romulan commander doesn't pursue Enterprise, right? When they are kind of on the ropes to finish them off, like you would think a warlike species would do. He admits that he grows weary of war. Is this compassion from a warlike race? What are your thoughts?
Yes and no, I guess. It really kind of goes both ways. I'll be perfectly honest. I don't, not entirely up to my snuff on Earth-Romulan War lore. But there's, I love this episode for so many reasons. And one of them is, I think this is like the best introduction to a species in Star Trek. I think that, you know, people are like, oh, the Romulans, they're so bad. They're so bad. Like, they're the bad guys. And it's like, are they really, though? They're like, they seem fine. I mean, yes, they have this very warlike culture, but, you know, like you said, the commander is, he's kind of tired of it. He's kind of what he, like, I mean, going back to the cage, he's wondering, like, you know, is this really all that life is? Is it really just all, is it all war? And it kind of gets flipped that the, you know, the Enterprise is seen as this warship by the Romulans. And the Romulan commander, you know, he congratulates Kirk. You're a great tactician. Yeah. You're a great captain. You know, he has that line, you know, in another life, we probably could have been friends. And I think that's absolutely true. I think they could have, you know, had their cultures not been sort of told that this is what you're supposed to do. Like, you're supposed to be at war with everybody that, like, everybody on, like, the Federation side. And that it's not necessarily the warlike race versus the compassionate explorers. There's not really a good side and there's not really a bad side. And I think that's kind of, that's mirroring what was actually going on. You know, 1966, we have the Vietnam War. We just had the Korean War. And a lot of these people watching probably grew up during World War II. So they, I think.
Good point.
I think that having not necessarily a villain and not necessarily like a good, like the good guys, I think would have probably resonated a lot more then, I think, than it does now.
Right. I think, I think all of us can at least admit in at least at times, good and evil are relative. And there's a lot of shows, especially sci-fi, does a good job of conveying that idea. You know, at first glance, you know, the Romulans could be easily thought of as evil. But are they just following their culture? I mean, this is what they do. You know, I mean, I'm not saying, you know, their thing is conquest through strength, whereas, you know, the Federation thing, and right now, of course, it's still very Earth-centric. Is cooperation through mutual respect. I mean, mm-hmm. Who's to say who's evil?
And I think that's when you said mutual cooperation because of respect, I think, you know, the Romulan commander and Kirk both having like a pretty high opinion of one another, I think could have if that was explored a little bit more, it could have taken the series in a very different direction as far as the Romulans are concerned.
Yeah, agreed. Agreed. I mean, somewhere out there in the vast multiverse, you know, the Romulans are Federation allies, if not members of the Federation, or, you know, Kirk and the Romulan commander are friends that are serving together. Mm-hmm. So Mark, I'm going to move on to, or Joe, this is kind of for both of you. Now, Mark, I think you've already told us who created the Romulans, right? So who created the Romulans again? Was it?
The writer, Paul Schneer, Snyder, excuse me.
Paul Schneider, right. So he created the Romulans. Why do you think they're so similar to Vulcans? Now, I know they're Vulcan offshoots, but this is maybe thousands of years in the past that this happened. Why are they still so similar to Vulcans in appearance? But not just in appearance, guys, because I've noticed if you really look at the Romulans and kind of study the Romulans in this episode in particular, they do have a lot of Vulcan-like traits. They don't seem to be overly emotional, although they do pay attention to their emotions, and they do seem to be, you know, very, you know, of course, very intelligent. But how many episodes of the original series are the Romulans in? To my memory, I think there's only the two, right? There's this one and
just the only two I know of, yeah.
Right, and the Enterprise incident in season three, right? Probably one of my top five episodes. We'll get there, guys. We'll get to that one. In fact, that's up next for us to do. But yeah, guys, go ahead, comment on that. The similarities, why are they so familiar? Why are they so similar if they're thousands of years apart? Or Joe, am I mistaken? Is there an actual timeline as to when they left Vulcan to go find their own thing?
I think it was around. It could have been around the time in the Enterprise series where they're talking about Serac and the teachings of Serac. I think they became like the distant cousins of the Vulcans. They were the group that rejected the teachings of Serac and pure logic. They wanted to do their own thing and live their own way. So I guess they established eventually they ended up establishing a separate colony, which became Romulus. And that's what carried on from there.
So probably not enough time. I mean, there's two things. Maybe not enough time to be physically different from their Vulcan ancestors or their Vulcan friend, you know, cousins. And then maybe, you know, not enough budget to make them so different in the series. I mean, you know, it's rears its ugly head all the time.
Now, I have a quick question about, this is definitely a Joe question, because you brought it up. So you were just talking about the like group of Vulcans that were like an offshoot that wanted to like do their own thing. Mm-hmm. In, is it Star Trek V?
Mm-hmm.
Where we meet Cybok. Is he part of that? Is that the same group or is that something totally different?
It could be something totally different because he's Vulcan.
Mm-hmm.
But I think he was trying to free people's minds or something he was doing. I forget what it was.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I need to watch the movie again.
Yeah, I rewatched that. But I don't think he's a part of that. He might be a part of that. Yeah, that sect of teaching the teachings of Serac.
Mm-hmm.
Right. He's clearly rejected those teachings.
Yeah.
But he's not Romulan at all.
No, he's not Romulan.
Yeah.
And I think
because his mother was a Vulcan princess.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, and he is using some of his Vulcan telepathic powers to influence people, and you know. Right. To give them all the visions that we're shown and everything. Anyway, we'll get to that one when we get to that one. But moving along, let's get into Mr. Stiles now. Joe, staying with you, it's established that Mr. Stiles, he's not really a bigot, that he has a reason for being hostile towards Mr. Spock. And that is family history, okay, right. For the Romulans. So tell us about the Stiles family history.
As far as from what I saw gathered from Memory Alpha, all that I know is that his family, he had family members that fought in the Earth Romulan War, and they were killed. And so that hatred for the Romulans, that's where that hatred stems from. And
like generational hatred.
Yeah, generational hatred. And because even though Spock's not Vulcan, he puts him in that category.
Right. Right. Yeah. Very difficult to I guess when you have that kind of history, very difficult to it would maybe not difficult, but it would take something special to, you know, kind of inwardly search and say, okay, wait a minute, this guy is not Romulan. Yeah. There's something going on here. Let me give him an opportunity to explain.
Yeah.
You would think in 200 years, 250 years from now, with mm-hmm. the 20th century that we're all in reality, we would have a lot more of us would have, you know, gathered those skills, you know, to not persecute someone for what they look like.
Yeah.
But then, you know, Ali, a very real example there of what was going on, especially at the time in the United States in the 60s. Very real there with all of that. Mark,
yes.
Tell us about the actor who played Mr. Stiles.
Mr. Stiles, Mr. Paul Kumi, started acting in 1957, continued into 1995. He has hundreds of television guest appearances, 20 movies, and a handful of reoccurring roles on television series. He first appeared 3 times on The Twilight Zone in the episodes People Are Alike All Over, The Odyssey of Flight 33, and The Parallel. Mm-hmm. Comey was also one of several Star Trek guest stars to appear in the 1980s series The Facts of Life, along with William Wyndham, Kenneth Tygar, Roger Perry, Eve Smith, who actually appeared in the same episode as Comey in Star Trek, and even, believe it or not, guys, lead Star Trek Deep Space Nine actor Armin Shimerman made a brief appearance in the show's 7th season premiere episode.
No kidding.
He also appeared in Roddenberry's The Lieutenant with Walter Koenig, a.k.a. Chekhov, and he appeared in The Fugitive with James Doohan, a.k.a. Scotty.
Wow.
And lastly, for this last Star Trek connection, he also appeared in such films as Conquest of Planet of the Apes, 1972, with none other than Ricardo Montalban, a.k.a. Khan.
That's like 0 degrees of separation.
Yeah. Right? Yeah, I've already offline talked to Mark about maybe doing a 6 degrees of separation or whatever degree of separation to our characters that we're going to be discussing. But you certainly got it there. Okay, guys, I want to moving along. I want to get to this kind of like the whole cat and mouse game of cat and mouse. Okay, on it's on, right? Just like naval submarine warfare, this is evident, especially inside the Romulan ship with its cramped quarters. They even make phaser fire from the Enterprise look and feel like torpedo shots, right? Now, I originally thought this might be the first episode that we see the ship's phasers being fired. It's not. They're in at least one other episode that aired before in the Corbomite maneuver where they destroy that cube spinning buoy thing from Baylock. Mm-hmm. But for some reason, they've decided to change the phaser shots to make them look like torpedo shots. And if you notice, when the phaser shots are fired, the ship jeers a little, you know, it jeers a little, very similar to what at least the early submarines, you know, would have experienced as well. We get to see the Enterprise really as a warship here rather than a vessel of exploration. Yeah. Which we know is their primary mission anyway. And then there's this whole silent running thing going on, okay, where they're whispering, okay. I know that's probably done. Do you agree that it was, Joe, this is for you. Do you agree that it was just there to enhance the tension? I mean, you know, everybody knows sound can't travel through the vacuum. You know, you can shout as loud as you want in the Enterprise. No one's going to hear you on board the Romulan ship.
Right.
Right?
Yeah. So
tell us about the whole, cat and mouse submarine warfare parallel here.
Yeah, it does. It does parallel between the fight between a submarine and a destroyer, and that whole scene of, you know, the phasers firing. They didn't know, they didn't really know their exact position, so they were firing phasers in random patterns, just like as if you were to drop depth charges from a destroyer. You don't have the exact, they don't know the exact position of the submarine, but they know the location, but they'll drop the depth charges where they think the submarine might be, and they drop them in close proximity.
Right. So the definite parallel with there, with depth charge warfare, and just, I think it was kind of cool how the whole, you could, let me just move on to Mark for my next question, which was, what were the inspirations for this episode? Is it based on anything? Were there movies, war movies that kind of, you know, showcase the same kind of game going on here?
Yeah. So it's actually the plot of the episode is actually based off the 1957 film, The Enemy Below. With the Enterprise taking the part of the American destroyer and the bird of prey with its cloaking device taking part of the submarine, which is also something that I forgot to mention to you guys at the beginning of the episode. This episode is also showing the premiere of a cloaking technology device.
Right.
Back
right.
to the inspiration for the episode. It also says that Schneider may have also been inspired by another submarine film, Run Silent, Run Deep.
Burt Lancaster.
Yeah. You know, you brought it up. Since you brought up the cloaking device, Joe, a question for you. Why can't the Romulan cloaking device defeat sensors? Okay, now, is it because it's a relatively new technology, even to them? In future series, future Star Trek shows, the cloak renders the ship invisible to sensors as well as visually as well. But here it seems to be only visual. So how do we account for that in within canon of Star Trek?
Ask that question again. You said why can't they be visual to sensors?
Yeah. So in this episode, we see the cloaking device work against visual detection.
Right.
But they are forced to detect it using sensors. Right. In fact, they later use sensors to aim the phasers.
Right.
And he says, Kirk says, or somebody says, not as accurate as I guess the phaser sensors that are built into the phaser arrays, but it's all we have. And Kirk says it would take a wild stroke of luck. And of course, Kirk gets his wild stroke of luck by hitting the Romulans. But yeah, so why was the technology like not so maybe advanced back then? Do you think that was just the case?
Yeah, it could have been. Yeah, it wasn't. They were still. It was still in the its infancy. They were still testing its technology. They're still going through like trial and error. With those 23rd century systems, they were still like primitive to, I guess, 24th century.
Right. And actually, it makes sense. And I appreciate that, them putting that in here. It's kind of a technology that will be stepped up as we go through the years, right, and centuries in Star Trek. I kind of, now that I'm thinking of it, I really appreciate them doing that and not just giving the Romulans a complete, you know, OP, overpowering weapon. So I do appreciate that. Allie, for you, question for you. There's talking about this parallel between World War II, the book. Is there a parallel? We talked about the ships, but is there a parallel between the crews, the Enterprise crew and the Romulan crew? If you were to compare and contrast the crews, I guess, for both ships, what would you highlight?
I think certainly the most prominent is the relationship between the commanding officer and the advisor. For the Enterprise, obviously it's Kirk, and then particularly in this episode, it's more McCoy, but you have like the Kirk,
right,
Spock, McCoy dynamic. And then on the Romulan crew, you have the commander and his Centurion, who
Interesting.
You know that you can tell just from the first couple of minutes that they're on screen together that they're very, very good friends. They've probably worked together for many, many years. They've known each other for many, many years, probably their entire lives. Mm-hmm. They trust each other implicitly. They rely on each other's advice, just the same exactly the same way that Kirk does with his advisors, Spock and McCoy. But I feel like, I know we're going to talk about McCoy later on, but and I also feel like the two crews also, you know, as a ship as a whole, they do know that, you know, this mission could be their very last mission, and they're prepared for that. You know, they have both crews have a very strong sense of like what duty is, what they signed up for. There's not really panic from either side. They sort of play everything very cool. This is how we work. This is how it's going to get done. And if it doesn't, then at least we know we did our jobs.
Yeah,
I think the level of skill of both crews is very, very, very skilled crews on either side.
Yeah, that was going to be my point. You read my mind. The level of training is adamant, is mm-hmm. Evident here in between both of the crews. So your point is dead on that you know, even though Starfleet is a vessel of exploration, in Enterprise included, they are as we will see throughout the series in Star Trek, they are armed, sometimes armed to the teeth. You'll get ships like Defiant and that coming out in Deep Space Nine and things like that are built for actual battleships. Good point. I think it's a good time for Mark to tell us a little bit about the actors that were playing the Romulans. We're talking so much about the Romulans. And absolutely, don't forget the absolutely fantastic actor, Mark Leonard.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So we'll start off with Desis. Lawrence Montague. He portrayed one of the first Romulans on Star Trek. He later played a Vulcan named Stone in the second season episode Amok Time.
Yeah.
He give you some more background information on him. He began his career as a dancer before turning into acting. He's a former United States Marine. According to the making of Star Trek by Stephen E. Woodfred, in the event that if Leonard Nimoy hadn't left the series in the second season, Montague was actually on the list to possibly replace him along with the Romulan commander there, Mark Leonard.
So if Spock were to leave, if he would have left after the first season,
yeah,
either one of those would have taken his place and become Spock.
Yeah, and it was mainly between those two actors, even though the studio was like trying to scare Nimoy and his agent by saying, oh, we have this long list of other actors that we could get, when really it was just those two. Yeah. Now,
aren't we glad? I mean, I think I can speak for every Star Trek fan. Are we glad that Spock didn't leave?
Right.
Yeah.
Or Leonard Nimoy didn't leave. Yeah. Go ahead.
He, most notably in 1967, he was seen as Mr. Glee, a robot controlled by the Joker, in two episodes of The Batman, The Joker's Last Lab and The Joker's and The Joker's Joke. In 2007, he returned to the role of Stone in the fan film Star Trek of Gods and Men. In late 2007, he portrayed Commander Veller in the pilot episode of the audio series Star Trek, The Continuing Mission. Now, let's head on over to the Romulan commander, Mark Leonard. He's got a long rap sheet here. He was an American actor best known for his role as, get ready for this, guys, Vulcan Ambassador Sarek. That's right, Spock's father. So not only was this guy the first Romulan commander, but he's also Ambassador Sarek.
And Spock's dad.
Mm-hmm. He first played Sarek in the TOS second season episode, Journey to Babel. He was a veteran of the Second World War, joined the U.S. Army in 1943, to becoming a paratrooper in Europe. He rose rapidly through the enlisted ranks until he was discharged as a technical sergeant in 1946. Now, here's where the acting really comes in. During his military service, he was actually chosen for a lead role in an army presentation of Valpoon to tour throughout Europe. This was his first acting experience. Now, he's often credited with being the first Romulan to appear in Star Trek. However, by strict order of screen appearance, the honor falls to Lawrence Montague as Deceased, who appeared seconds before Mark even appeared on screen wearing his helmet covering his Romulan ears.
I did notice that. Yeah. He was, and it is literally a second or two before Mark turns around and there's his face, you know. And by the way, yeah, those Romulan helmets, I mean, you don't have to go through makeup and get some more ears. So you just put the helmet over. You know, again, saving costs. Go ahead. Yeah. Continue with Mark Leonard.
He resumed the role of Sarek in 3 Star Trek motion films: Star Trek III, The Search for Spock, Star Trek, The Voyage Home, and Star Trek, The Undiscovered Country.
Right.
And on Star Trek, The Next Generation, in the episodes Sarek and Unification 1, he also voiced the role in Star Trek, The Animated Series, Yesteryear.
Oh, fantastic, fantastic acting performance in the Next Generation episode. Yeah. I wasn't thinking of that one.
Not only is he a Vulcan and a Romulan, but he also became the first actor to play a Klingon with forehead ridges.
Mm-hmm.
What?
Yeah.
Yeah, the motion picture.
And the first to speak the Klingon language as well.
Yeah.
When
wow.
he appeared as the Klingon captain of the IKS Armar in Star Trek, the motion picture. He actually requested to reprise his role as Sarek for the film, but when his request was declined, he was offered the role of the Klingon captain instead. In 1991, he appeared for the last time in Star Trek as Sarek in the Star Trek Next Generation episode Unification 1.
Yeah, wow. I know I've seen him all over the place. I didn't realize certain things. He's even more involved with Star Trek than I even thought. So,
and even after all of that, during the 1990s, are you guys ready for this? I don't think you are. He toured throughout the country with Star Trek regular Walter Coing in a 2-man play, The Boys of Autumn. In this play, Leonard and Coing portrayed Huckleberry Finn, and Tom Sawyer, respectively, who meet for the first time in 50 years as old men.
Oh my
That's
god!
That's so cute.
Right?
Wait a minute. So, which one did Mark Leonard play? Tom Sawyer?
It doesn't say here.
I can't even imagine.
Yeah,
I can't even imagine. You know, I just imagine, you know, him walking through the woods and being like, "No, oh, now Huckleberry, that's highly illogical." I don't know.
I do want to say. Going back to what I was talking before about like the introduction of the Romulans, and I think part a big reason of why this episode was such a good introduction as to the Romulans as being like so unlike what they were expected to be, and I think that's because of Mark Leonard bringing like.
Agree.
Raising the bar, really, for basically all of the rest of the crew for the episode.
Yeah.
I just thought he brought this like respect and gravitas to the Romulan people as a whole. That like, even after this, that everybody who follows needs to at least be as good as this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I 100% agree. I think, and I also think that many, I think, fell short of that, particularly in the Next Generation. When they realized that they couldn't make the Ferengi into a believable enemy, so they just went with the Romulans. And so I thought a lot of Romulans did live up to his role, or his example, but I think some didn't do that. But I think. For those of you who are sports fans, and if you know me, you know I'm a big sports fan. They talk about when a team gets a certain player, could be a key player, that will make everybody else around them better, right? And I do think that that's the same with a lot of industries, in particular acting as well. So I think what you were saying, Mark, is as far as, and also Ali, you were alluding to it, Mark Leonard, when he's on screen, when he just made everybody better, you know? He made everybody want to be better. And I think the same happened for him. We've talked about it a little bit offline. Ricardo Montalban, right? In Space Speed.
Oh, yeah.
When he came on, he just made everybody better anyway. So, you know, it was a sad day when he passed away. I remember. I don't remember what year it was, but I do remember.
Mark Leonard?
Yeah.
He passed away in 97, I think.
97, yeah. Yeah, it was a sad day, but, you know, we can't all last forever. Yeah. I'm going to try to break that rule. But anyway, okay. Yeah, more on the Romulans. Oh, Ali, I want to go to you about, you know, we talked about it a little bit. There's definitely a wartime feel to this episode, even though a state of war does not exist technically. What does war have that we had in this episode? I mean, we have failed strategy. We have successful strategy. We have luck, and that's Kirk's wild stroke of luck with his phaser shots, aka Joe's depth charges, right? We have the threat of espionage. You know, Styles, I'm saying we might have a spy on board the ship. And Spock's like, I agree. We have experience of wartime loss, okay? And we also have the concepts of dehumanization of enemies. We have love and loss, right? And we have the toll that war takes on a person physically and mentally, right? So just want to get like your thoughts on that whole, you know, paralleling wartime feel.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's definitely like, I think the biggest theme of this episode is war, obviously. You know, 1966 is only 26 years after World War II, 13 years after the Korean War. We're at the height of the Vietnam War. We're at the height of the Cold War. You know, all of those kind of in order, you go through all of basically all those things that you were saying, the failed strategy, the successful strategy, the luck, the espionage, all of that is contained within people's lifetimes. You know, yeah. somebody who was a child in World War II is maybe 30 years old and is probably going to be interested in Star Trek watching this episode thinking, oh my God, I've lived through every war imaginable by this point. And I think I don't think there would be a person watching this who would not be affected in some capacity by a war. Whether you're pro or anti-war, I think this really, it would have resonated with everybody watching it.
Absolutely.
And I think another big theme of the episode is that it humanizes the individual within the war and vilifies the war itself, which I think was a big, definitely a big sentiment during the 60s that people were opposing the Vietnam War for, you know, it's kind of a silly, stupid war. And that's exactly what we're seeing in this episode. You know, both sides are kind of like, well, we don't really know why this needs to be a thing.
Right.
This is a silly, stupid war. We don't need to be fighting it, but yet we are. It's just the way that it's always been.
Right. Even the Romulans, like, and to the point that was brought up earlier, even the Romulans come to the point that this is stupid.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Romulan commander, he's not going to go finish him off because all he wants to do, what will that accomplish?
Yeah.
That will accomplish anything. That will definitely cause a war if we go and destroy mm-hmm. him. Mm-hmm. You know, yeah.
Yeah. And it also shows that, like, you know, war isn't just the victory. It's also, you know, you have death and loss on both sides. And I think one of the big reasons why I like this episode so much is because of Ensign Martine and sort of her whole story throughout this episode.
Right.
And I think a lot of people watching who did lose somebody Especially her line at the end, that her just, she just says, "I'm fine. I'm fine. I think it's comforting for families who lost somebody. You're going to be okay. It doesn't necessarily have to be now, but you'll be okay. And even if you're not okay, that's still okay. It's okay to not be okay as well. Absolutely. And I think that's a really important thing, I think.
Agree.
For people to see.
100%. And also timely as to the time of this broadcast that we're making, but just the tremendous loss that a lot of people in our country are feeling with the natural disasters, you know, Hurricane Ida, the mm-hmm. fires out west and all of that stuff as well. So yeah, it is okay to not be okay. But Joe, I wanted to move on real quick. We talked a little bit about the Vulcans and Rymlands and the split there. Why do you think it's almost as if Spock has no knowledge of this split? Do you think that's true? I mean, it seems to be like the Vulcans maybe don't know that there was a bunch of Vulcans that said, you know what? We like our emotions. We don't like the teachers of Sarek, and we're going to go and find our own and do our own thing. Do you think that this was a very, like, not a well-known like event in Vulcan history, or you think it maybe was just forgotten over the centuries?
It was one of those things where it was just, we don't talk about them. It was a forbidden subject. I think like amongst the high priest, they knew about it, but they kind of kept it within the sanctuary of Vulcan, where they go to like do their Vulcan rituals. Right. They kept it within their conclave. It was one of those things where it just wasn't talked about. Yeah. And maybe like Sarek could have known about it as well, but he didn't expose Spock to that.
Interesting, because we do in later series, and one of the later series, of course, is Enterprise, which actually is before this one in the timeline. We do find that this is a big part or a sizable part of Vulcan culture, mm-hmm. to not talk about things. You don't talk about it.
Right.
They don't talk about their emotions, right? They don't talk about their history, their savage history a lot. Mm-hmm. So absolutely interesting, makes a lot of sense. And that probably is why they don't know, they don't know about it. So of course they don't know what they're gonna look like. I just thought it was interesting, and back me up if you caught this, where, for the first time, and we were talking about that scene where Mark Leonard turns around and he's a dead ringer for a Vulcan, and Stiles immediately turns to Spock, and he's looking at Spock, and Spock has this look on his face like, he's like, oh great, you know, like he's thinking, oh great, you know, not only am I a Vulcan among humans, but now I look like the enemy, you know, mm-hmm. just like, and he's, you know, he's also got this look like, you know,
well, that's just great.
Yeah, that's just great, you know, but is this, you know, in a way, this is logical, you know, or, you know, just like, you know, just what the universe would do to me, you know, it's like, I just thought one of the lighter moments in the episode. Yeah, so going to the whole Stiles and Spock thing, Allie, what about this interaction between Spock and Stiles? I mean, to my knowledge, this is the first appearance of bigotry, right, in the Star Trek universe, or is it bigotry? Is it just Stiles's wish for vengeance for his ancestors? Interesting to me that when they, you know, like I said, he immediately looks back at Spock, who's got that look on his face, and later on in the episode, the camera zooms in on Spock. You see him sitting at his science station, and then he just turns around to see Stiles staring at him. And as if he felt, you know, his eyes burning a hole in the back of his body. You know, we know Spock is, you know, Vulcans are somewhat telepathic. But yeah, your thoughts on that whole interaction between the two.
I think at one point in my notes, I actually mentioned that one, the one look that Spock gives of just like, oh, I guess this is it, of that. I was almost expecting him to like turn and look directly in the camera like he's on The Office.
Yeah, he almost broke the fourth wall. Like,
mm-hmm. I guess you're wondering how I ended up here.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, obviously, like to your point, and it's been a minute since I watched the episodes that like lead up to this one. I've kind of skipped around a little bit, but I'm gonna say that this is the first exploration of bigotry on Star Trek, although it might be, but it's certainly the first exploration of bigotry between from one crew member against another crew member.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, going back to, you know, the whole thing about being old enough to remember World War II and remembering that we did the same thing. We did the same thing in World War II. You know, anybody who looked like the enemy, Japan was the enemy.
Yeah.
We put people in internment camps.
Yeah.
And I think people are going to remember that. And I think it's not just that it's his family history. It is bigotry. He is a bigot. And I think watching him have this, I mean, it's too short. It's too like perfectly like, oh, I'm not racist anymore. I'm going to be your friend now. And I think it's too perfectly wrapped up. There's a lot.
Well, he saved his life.
We have a lot more to unpack here than just one act changing someone's viewpoint.
Well, he did save his life. I mean, that's pretty important.
It's pretty important, but I think there's a lot more that needs to be talked about. If that's kind of the road that we were in initially going down. I mean, I know that they're strapped for time. They can only make these episodes like 40, 45 minutes. But I definitely feel like it's sort of the fairy tale version, like the perfect fit for TV version that I think it could, if it was explored a little bit more, it could have gone in a really interesting way. But that they were just strapped for time or money or couldn't fit it in anywhere or any way else that they could. And I do think, on the other hand of that, I do think it's important for people who have these lingering prejudices, who are like holdouts of World War II or like McCarthy era communist suspicion.
Oh yeah.
That they see themselves in Styles and like look inside themselves and think like, well, why do I feel like that? Why do I act like that? How can I make myself better the way that this dude did?
Yeah.
So like on the other hand, it's the good and the bad depiction of the sort of redemption of the racist.
And I also want to add that, you know, that the, you know, the scene where Spock, you know, saves his life, it goes back to that saying, you know, be careful about how you treat people, because the very person that you hate or hate on could be the very same person that could save your life one day,
or that you may be relying on to do right. that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. This is all, yeah, this is all in line with Gene Roddenberry's mission of how he wants the show to be, you know, exploring modern topics in a futuristic setting. You know, I think it's all right in there with what he wanted Star Trek to be. Joe, at one point, I want to ask you, did you catch, like, at one point, after Spock turns around and has and Styles is staring at him, burning holes in the back with his eyes, another scene is Spock just comes. He walks over to the navigation station and he puts his hands on the side of Styles, and he just like he doesn't say a word, and he just looks at his console, looks at the screen, kind of looks at him side eye, and walks away. And to me, that was Spock saying, you know, listen, mister, you know, I'm still your executive officer and superior officer.
Exactly. You
will respect me. Did you catch that? Say,
regardless of what you may think, I'm still here and I'm still above you.
Right. Right.
That was such a power move.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was a power move. And I'm wondering if Spock maybe took a book from his human friends and maybe his human half by thinking that that was necessary at that point, you know? Maybe even he relied on a little bit of his academy training, you know, what to do when you have a subordinate officer who's being a little unruly, you know, sometimes let your body language do the talking.
Right.
You know?
I felt like Kirk was a little bit lenient towards Stiles, because the way Stiles was kind of like being insubordinate even towards Kirk, Picard and Sisko would have put him in his place a long time ago, long before they even started.
Agreed. Actually, Kirk showed, and I remember thinking this too, Kirk showed restraint.
Yeah.
You know? Excellent point there. And, you know, guys, later on, speaking of Kirk and speaking of body language and respect given to a senior officer, there's a scene where Kirk comes into the bridge. I don't remember where he's coming from, but he comes into the bridge. He doesn't say a word. His first stop is to go over to Uhura. Uhura knows immediately what to say to him and what he's expecting. He says he gets what he needs. He leaves. He goes over to Sulu. Sulu gives him exactly what he needs. He goes over to Stiles. Stiles tells him exactly what he needs. Goes over to Spock. Spock tells him exactly. What respect is that? Okay, you don't have to say a word. You'll walk onto the bridge, and they know what you want. They know what you expect, right? Mm-hmm. That's discipline, right? Mm-hmm. Right there. That's military discipline. Let's see. I had a couple of kind of fun things in here. At one point, Kirk tells Sulu that they're going to make a quote end run. For my fellow football fans out there, you know that's a football play. Okay, so football in the 23rd century, right? Football. I don't know if that's still around, but a football reference. I thought that was very, very interesting. The one kind of thing I didn't like about this episode, if you go back, you can try to catch it. Kirk spends an inordinate amount of time making sure his phaser crews are ready. It's like every other minute, he's like, are phaser crews ready? Do phaser crews signal ready? Signal phaser crews ready. And I'm like, all right, already. You know, if they say they're ready, they're ready. Did you guys get that same, like,
idea? Yeah, I did pick up on that. But that it made me think about, like, how if you're on, like, a destroyer and, okay, you're manning the anti-aircraft guns or the 5-inch the 40-inch guns. The captain is calling back and forth, like, gunners, are you ready or something like that? Yeah.
Right. Yeah. 40 millimeter. 40-inch gun would be really big.
Yeah.
That would be really devastating.
Yeah.
That. to bring the episode to a close, and Ali, you touched on a little bit. At the end, when the captain is with Angela in the chapel, and he's trying his best to comfort her, but he really sees that she's going to be okay, and he's like, "Okay, I've done my duty as her senior officer." He walks out of the chapel. Easily, the episode could have ended right there, but it didn't. It shows him walking down the corridors of the Enterprise. It shows a regular day. People, it's a busy corridor. People are walking around for sure. But it just gave me the sense of, you know, in the end, life and duty goes on. He's got his job to do. He's got his crew to run, his ship to run. It just shows, you know, it's as if this was saying, this was just one day in our crew's life and crew's experiences. Mm-hmm. Right? Did you guys get that scene that sense too? I thought it was powerful.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. You definitely get the feel. There's a lot of episodes where you get the feeling that space is a job.
Yeah.
And we know Angela knows what she signed up for. The whole crew knows what they signed up for.
Right.
And I like that about Star Trek, that it's not like, oh, this fantastical future world. It's people at work.
Right.
Yeah. And it also, Kirk meant, I know in one or two episodes, Kirk says it to some of his officers, but you also hear it throughout the other Star Trek series where they tell you, when you put on this uniform, you accept the risk that come with it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Good point. Yes. Very, yeah, very good. That's absolutely true. Yeah, space is a job. Mark, I'm going to give you the last word here. I want you, is there anything else that you think we might want to know about this episode as far as from a production or a casting sense? Are there any references made to this episode in canon, in other future episodes? Okay. Is there any reference material, Mark, that you may think that our viewers might want to, you know, take note of? Go ahead.
Oh yeah, for sure. So in an alternate timeline in the Star Trek Beyond universe, both Robert Tomslin and Angela Martin were members of the USS Enterprise crew in that universe. They both survived the ship's destruction above Altmid, which is a planet in 2164, the Federation U.S. starship Franklin crashed, landed on that planet. Only three crew members survived, including Captain Baltazar Edison and his officers.
Again, Baltazar Edison, yes.
Yeah. His officers Anderson Lee and Jessica Wolfe. Unable to contact Starfleet and seeing no sign of rescue, Edison and the crew came to embrace the anti-Federation ideology. They were both captured. Both Robert and Angela were captured by Krall, a.k.a. Captain Edison, a.k.a. Idris Elba, and killed together in demonstration of energy transference tech to Lieutenant Sulu and Uhura. Now, the Star Trek Beyond co-writer Simon Pegg stated that those names of two particular crew members killed by Krall were taken from Balance of Terror.
Excellent. Wow, connections all over the place.
And I also have another small connection about Leonard Mark. This guy does not give up. He worked with Ken Penders to write a comic story titled The Lessons of Life that was to be published by DC Comics as a prestige hardcover graphic novel tied in with the release of Sarek novel from Pocket Books. But the project died. But this led Leonard to writing Blood and Honor, a Star Trek Deep Space Nine comic released in 1995, where the son of his Romulan character from Balance of Terror met the descendant of James T. Kirk on Deep Space Nine.
Aha.
Yeah.
Interesting. Joe, I know you kind of follow some of the written material and stuff like that. And you as well, Mark. Have you read that series? Seems like it would be pretty.
I've heard of Blood and Honor. I've never read it, though. Yeah.
I feel like I might have it somewhere in my collection.
Yeah, I might have it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, guys, by the way, behind Mark is just a little, you know, like
just 1%, a little.
Like 1% of what he has. I mean, yeah.
That's just the Trek section.
Yeah, just the Trek section. Yeah, showing us the action figures. Although he's got the kind of potentially creepy.
Yeah,
there he is. Yeah. Yeah, kind of life size almost.
Right. Now, if his head turned, Mark, I don't know what to tell you.
I don't know.
Guys, thank you guys so much for your insight. We have successfully made it through our first episode of Trek Soup. Guys, if you're interested, if you want to comment, find us on our Facebook page at Trek Soup, okay? You'll see our bios there, a little more information about all of us. Do join us for our next episode review. It's going to be the Enterprise incident, in keeping with the whole Romulan theme, in 2 weeks on September 20th at 8 p.m. And please enjoy the rest of your Labor Day weekend. And it's almost over. I know summer's almost over, but we have plenty of Star Trek to talk about. Okay. All right, guys, take care and thanks for joining us. Bye.
See you, everyone.
You got it.